Welcome to the Self-Made Mind Podcast. We'll be bringing you real-life, honest conversations with some of the world's elite performers, from sporting athletes to millionaire CEOs and everyone in between. Success leaves clues. And it's now our mission to deliver these stories so you can start writing your own self-made script.
Hello guys, welcome to another episode of the Self-Made Mind Podcast. We have another very special guest with us today. Her name is Jan Cavell. She's an entrepreneur, author, writer and speaker. And I'm sure she's got a lot of important nuggets of wisdom to share with us today. A big welcome to you, Jan Cavell.
Alex, thank you so much. Thank you for asking me here.
That's all right, no problem. So just before we get started, Jan, obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's the 12th of October 2020 right now. The world's gone mad. And I'm just wanting to, well, just curious of how it's affected you, Jan, and how you're coping with it at the minute.
Good question. I mean, I'm an awful lot luckier than most because I live on my own and I work from home. So, you know, on a practical basis, it didn't affect me too badly. But, you know, I think the hardest thing for me is my son lives in Australia. And, of course, Australia's closed its borders. And he was actually ill at the beginning of the pandemic, very seriously ill. Right. And nothing to do with the pandemic. But I couldn't go. And, you know, which as a mum is the hardest thing. Apart from that, I've been incredibly lucky, but it is really tough. And I so feel for the people running businesses. It must be, well, I mean, I've got friends who still have businesses full time and it, you know, just the stress and the strain they must be under is horrendous.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's, have you got kind of any advice you'd give to someone who said they might be the struggling maybe just mentally to get by at the moment? What advice would you have at the moment for that, John?
I think, I mean, you know, as you very kindly mentioned, I'm a writer and I interview a lot of people and I'd probably come back to an American entrepreneur who said to me recently, you know, in an interview, he said, you know, tell people in business not to think about next year. You know, don't even think about next month. Just take it one day at a time, get through today and cope with surviving today and make it the best you can for now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all you can do. I think it's just about just ticking over at the moment. I think that's, and I think the rest of the country is in the same, well, the rest of the world, sorry, is in the same boat. So, I mean, it's kind of comforting in that way because everyone's going through it at the same time, I suppose. So you've just got to just remain as positive as you can. We can't change it and just adapt.
That's right. Yeah. And I think change is always known to be one of the biggest problems for us as humans, where, you know, biggest challenges to get our heads around change.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that in itself is a toughie. I don't know about you, but I still know a lot of people who are sort of, you know, talking about when this is over and when we're back to normal. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, we won't be the same. You know, we might be changed for the better and lots of things, you know, but businesses will be different. The way we live life will be different. And that people really are still fighting, I think.
Yes, absolutely. The sooner it's done, the better. But like you say.
Oh, yeah. Not going to argue with you there.
Right, Jan. Like I say, I really appreciate you coming on for a chat, Jan. I'm sure you're busy yourself. But so, yeah, let's get started. So, obviously, with any good story, Jan, I think it's good to start at the beginning. And let's talk about Jan Cavell as a child. And let's venture into that part of your life, if we can.
Of course we can.
Yeah.
I guess this is where my love of books started. Because I was quite an isolated child. I was born to very elderly parents, well, sort of comparatively elderly parents, as a late surprise, shall we say. We lived on a farm. So, you know, and of course it was sort of pre-days when everybody had cars and things, you know, so I was on my own a large portion of the time. And coupled with that, I was actually very ill a lot of my childhood, you know, so books were the absolute answer. And I loved reading, absolutely loved reading. You know, and it, I mean, I was perfectly happy actually, because to me that was normal. So I really forged my bookworm self then.
Yeah. So what, just to cut in there, John, sorry, what type of books have you got kind of fond memories of, you know, from growing up then? What were some of your favourite books then?
I had a sort of, I was going to say a limited selection. It was a wide selection, actually, but my mother was I think both parents were quite Victorian, again, from the age and childhood. So, and she was a passionate believer in reading the classics. So whereas other children got sort of, you know, whatever it was in those days, equivalent to Thomas the Tank Engine at night, you know, yeah. I'd get Dickens and Shakespeare in full. Right. So, you know, I got a really early classical education in reading, you know, which helped my education on English literature later on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I personally only got into books and reading probably only a few years ago when I first started to get into business, and I didn't realise the actual power of them. And I think it's obviously the fact that you can read through something and learn so much about say someone's life and lessons. I just think it's so powerful, and I always just thought books to me were fictional books. But you know, and when I discovered non-fiction and actual very valuable stuff in these books, it's just like, wow, that's
you know, light bulb.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, sort of with my love of books, I mean, I was allowed Lady Bird books. Right. They were considered acceptable when I was young. So I had historical Lady Bird, but all the history stories and scripture stories, well, of which I remember very little, it must be said. But but those two were allowed. So as far as history and Ibn Ari or whatever they call it these days at school, that was still books as far as I was concerned in English. Yeah. But, you know, give me any other book that I agree with you. That was terribly foreign. I didn't quite see the point of that. It wasn't lose yourself in a good story. It was, you know, how to dissect a plant, and it didn't do the same thing for me at all.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. So obviously after your childhood then, Jan, what was, so school life then, what was the education and school life like for you?
I was dispatched to boarding school. Because my parents were that bit older, and my father ended up having a series of heart attacks, and the whole thing was a bit sort of beyond them. So they packed me off initially to farm me out to another family for a while, and then I was sent to boarding school. You know, so which was tough because, of course, you know, English boarding schools are very sporty. And when I was first sent to prep school, I was what, sort of nine-ish, I guess, eight, no, I think I was nine. And it was a very sporty prep school, and I was still being very ill, which meant that, you know, most of the time I couldn't do the sports. And when I could do the sports, I was always last, you know, which is a tough, is a tough way to live life, actually, as a child. You know, you're not, it doesn't help you fit in. And I was miles from home, so when I was, you know, when I was ill, it was me and a son and a nurse popping in twice a day, you know, so
yeah.
It wasn't a bundle of fun.
I can imagine.
Yeah, because that's English boarding schools, the privileged life, they call it.
Yeah, so they say.
it has its moments. But,
okay, so after your school life then, Jan, did you always have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit about you? And what were the early signs of that then for you?
I always had a can I say bloody-minded streak?
If this does, yeah,
I hope that doesn't upset your viewers, which caused me to not really like being employed very much. You know, so I think that's where it came from originally. You know, I just wanted to, desperately wanted, work didn't worry me, hard work didn't worry me, but I didn't want to kind of tie to people and, you know, go and work in offices and do the right thing all the time. I did it for a short while, you know, because that was okay. I could see the point of that and, you know, of going to work desperately hard and then taking some time off or something, you know, but, and you know, having earned every penny I could, but actually sort of career-wise, you know, so I fell into a lot of selling jobs, particularly when I did have work, which was the best possible grounding I think anybody can have as an entrepreneur.
Right.
I swear by it. I know sales isn't very fashionable, but I do think it's a real boon. And, you know, then I started working for myself, you know, because that was even less stressful as far as I was concerned than even taking a long-term short job. You know, so it all began from that, really.
Right. And what was the first venture then for working for yourself?
Good question. I don't remember the first one. I mean, I dabbled in quite a few. I think selling wine, I think, was an early one. what might have been the first one for a German wine company, which may or may not still exist. But you know, I was freelancing, and so it was easy done, and I picked up the other bit of work from friends and bit of typing work and what have you. But that was probably the first one, I think.
Right. And then obviously that you started the furniture company then.
Is
there anything in between that gap there that's quite, you know, that's worth discussing business-wise?
Business-wise, I mean, I think only, oddly enough, you did ask me a question that you sent me, a sort of pivotal moment here, and I think...
Yeah.
While that's not directly business-wise, it was probably a very good preparation for life and coping with things moment, and encouraged by a friend at the time. You know, in those days, you know, sort of lots of people, I mean, most people didn't go traveling very much, and they certainly didn't go traveling on their own. But this happened to be somebody who was a bit older and was semi-mentoring me and one thing and another, and he encouraged me to do it. And I went off to Europe for a while, having saved a certain amount of pennies from a combination of sort of awful jobs from secretarial to washing up. And I went traveling. And I told my parents, of course, to shut them up, but I got a, you know, sort of summer rail ticket around Europe. I don't know if they still do them. I think they do.
Yeah.
So it was all frightfully respectable. And I, you know, was staying with various friends, which was a filthy lie, of course, because I didn't have enough money for any such thing. so I was hitching, and I was hitching on my own.
Right.
Which was slightly out of the comfort zone of you know, the sort of life I'd been brought up to. And it was amazing. You know, I mean, I remember just landing, and I took a train to Bruges. That's right. I was trying to think, where did I go? From the Channel Plot, and I was sort of, you know, hitching down the motorway and thinking, nobody in the world knows who I am or where I am. You know, this is up to me to make what I can of this. You know, and I'm in control. It may all go horribly wrong, and I may not stay totally in control, but you know, the choices are mine.
Yeah.
And it was so incredibly liberating. You know, and I did all sorts of strange things on that trip. You know, I took an extraordinary job on a, I was told I'd arrived down sort of south of France, where I did vaguely know of somebody I didn't know, and they let me sleep on their floor. But I would imagine they got fairly fed up with it, because they managed to trace me down a job, cooking for a boat, but it was very late in the season, so there were very few jobs around. And so this trip, I was near Nice, and this boat was over in near Marseille. So it, you know, so I took a train to Marseille and turned up on the day saying, "I'm your new cook." You know, I'd thought, you know, boat, yacht, Mediterranean. You know, absolutely not. This thing was an old ferry from the fjords. Right. And it had been bought by some families in conjunction with each other to see if they could make it into a nice holiday boat. And it was still in trials. So actually I was cooking for the crew, not for the families. Right. And we were taking it out to see if it was seaworthy.
Right.
Which it wasn't, I have to add. They had to get rid of it in the end because it had no stabilizers at all.
Right.
And if you try and cook in a kitchen of an old tank or old ferry boat with no stabilizers, you know, everything goes everywhere. You know, and just as an experience, I mean, you know, again, that was, you know, life of a raw. You know, you've got to cope with this. You've got to get on with it and make what you can of it. You know, so it was a really building experience, the whole thing. For me.
Brilliant. Yeah, it just kind of strikes me, Jan, that you're one of those characters that's not afraid to just chuck yourself in and just, you know, just give it your everything and just see what comes from it. And that's I think that's a really good trait in a person.
I think I got more fearful as time went by.
Yeah.
You know, but I think doing children did that to some extent because I got protected for them. And probably, I think it's very easy to lose confidence as you get older, you know, because life knocks you and it wears your confidence down. I was having said that, I was, you know, I had not entirely confident then. It's a battle for everybody. You know, we look at other people and think, you know, oh, they're so confident and they're getting on with life and they're so amazing, you know, and everybody's a mess, you know. You know, everybody suffers from these issues of imposter syndrome or lack of self-confidence. You know, they may look as if they're a confident MD of some massive company, but, you know, but really everybody's the same underneath.
I think so, yeah. Okay, John, so let's take it to starting the furniture company then, John, and just let's speak about that journey.
That journey came from the fact that I'd run a company with my ex-husband, and sort of briefly, and I'd had children, and we split up when they were very small, and I was extremely broke, so I thought the only answer was to work for myself again, and selling was the obvious choice. For a bit back to the selling of a wine job, you know, but I'd had some experience of furniture with my ex-husband, so I thought, okay, we'll stick with that. I thought, well, I'll sell furniture to interior designers again. You know, they must need furniture. Interior design was just taking off in this country as a whole new industry because it really didn't exist very much till then. Or, you know, it was for one or two people, not as a general industry.
Yeah. What year was this, John? Sorry, what year was this then?
Good question. When would it have been? It would have been late 90s, I would think.
Late 90s.
Maybe more mid-90s, actually, going back to thinking what age my children were. You know, we were just starting to have TV programs about interior design. So it was just starting to get fashionable, which was luck.
Good timing.
Absolutely. And so interior designers were springing up everywhere. You know, and so I started to sell. It wasn't at that stage manufacturing. A friend, there were problems not so much getting furniture made because I was in East Anglia at the time and there are a lot of craftsmen out there. But getting it finished in sort of interior design style wasn't so easy in, you know, with sort of old fashioned Suffolk craftsmen. Interior designers wanted the latest fashions and they wanted to make traditional oak, you know, so it was a slight culture gap. So a friend of mine started spraying the furniture in another friend's barn, and that made things much easier. So he got a friend of his to work with him as well, and I got a tiny industrial unit. So I had a tiny spraying business. And then a few years later, by default, I bought out the guy who was making the furniture. He had a small business and he wanted to retire. So I bought that out very much on a never never because I didn't have any cash. Put the two together and suddenly realized that I'd got something somewhat more substantial that was serious business, you know, which came as a bit of a shock, really.
Brilliant. So you managed to build the company up to quite a substantial size, Jan, and that's a credit to you in itself for doing that, because obviously people can have that entrepreneurial spirit and always just kind of keep it to a one-man band and one-woman band or one, sorry. And,
sure, no, it's not. One-person band. Should one we be pers- really PC?
One-person band, there you go. Yeah, what I'm trying to say is a lot of people will just get stuck in that singular mindset and you then took it to the next level. So can you just tell me about that kind of processing?
Of course I can.
And I believe this will relate to a book that you've got coming out next year?
Partly, you know, because what happened then, I had these two tiny companies sort of, and that was really because of necessity, because the guy was retiring and I was thinking I must have furniture because I've got to feed my children. But, you know, it was really became quickly essential and practical to put them under one roof. And so I ended up getting a unit, the only unit I could get, really, and a sort of proper factory unit. And there was me sort of staring at it and thinking, you know, what am I doing with this place? You know, it's crazy. And there were five of us at that point rattling around in this place. But it was one of my biggest challenges was that moment, because having arranged it all and taken on a massively long lease and massively expensive lease, it seemed to me. And, you know, there were my guys, you know, sort of in these tiny barns. You know, I just had no knowledge. It didn't occur to me that it was going to be expensive to do that. Or even cost anything, really. I just thought, you know, you threw this stuff in the back of the van and, you know, went on working that afternoon and, you know, life went on as normal, right. You know. And it was just such a mess that, you know, but it cost so much. You know, there was a sort of, you know, machinery to move and factory to be set up and cupboards to build. It was just an empty shell, you know, and we couldn't earn anything. And the whole costs of the thing rocketed and it was just disastrous. And, you know, I did what you really, really shouldn't do, which applies to a lot of my career, let's face it. But I took a loan out from the back of the Sunday paper because, I simply didn't know what else to do, because I was either going to default on the premises or I don't know. It just wasn't worth contemplating as far as I was concerned. I had to make the damn thing work and I had to keep money coming in for kids and, you know, not let these people down who'd come in with me, you know, to work there and everything. You know, so I took this loan out and I started to sell so seriously. I mean, I just lived and breathed sales. You know, and at night I'd stay up, you know, sort of looking up more and more contacts to sell to, and then I'd sell all day. And so it began to take off, and I began to get an idea of what people wanted, which of course is key, and I was lucky with the timing, and so we started to grow very fast. You know, which, you know, and all of a sudden I was being talked about as an entrepreneur and, you know, the whole thing was sort of was crazy, and it was just one growth, and we ended up needing another factory unit, and there were more people, and the whole thing morphed into something which I had no idea what I was doing with, really.
That's interesting. One thing to pick out of that, John, is when it kind of, when you took the loan out, did that kind of, it's kind of a do or die thing then, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
Just from analysing that, it just gives you that extra push to make it work at all costs, really. Is that what you said?
I mean, there was a huge practical, absolutely had to, but it had also very much become my life, and I loved it, and I loved the people I was working with at the time, and there were the kids, and it gave me the lifestyle that I wanted, which, you know, because I could have got a, well, I think I could have got a job, you know.
And, I'm sure you could have, John.
Let's not take a flyer at that one. But, you know, and put them into daycare, excuse me. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be around during, you know, bringing them up. And so a lot of my work was done from home, in fact. You know, so it just was providing me, them, and everything, and the people who work for me, I hope, with a good lifestyle, and I mean that literally, because it wasn't that it was financially all that rewarding at that stage, but you know, it gave us what we wanted out of it. So, and nobody was going to take that away. It had to work.
Absolutely, nobody
was trying, but you know, failure wasn't going to take it away.
Yeah,
lack of effort on my part.
Yeah, brilliant. So I heard you say that you lived and breathed it and you loved it. So a question that I did have, Jan, was what do you think on having passion for what you do? Do you think that you have to have passion order to get to the top?
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
And I know it was question you asked me, and you know, at the moment I looked at it, I thought, oh, I know the answer to that. Yes. I think it's absolutely essential. And actually what really happened to me is, you know, I had this, what was in essence, very successful business, award-winning business that sort of grew and everything else. And as the children got older and left home and no longer needed me, you know, the passion for me really went out of it. You know, it became a sensible should do thing.
Right.
And you know, that just, it's not got the same feel of it at all.
Right. So do you think you kind of, so you're saying that the kids left, so was the main sort of driver for you to supply for your kids then, and then when when you didn't have to do that anymore, and that's when it kind of dropped away, would you say?
Yes, definitely. You know, I mean, it's funny, I actually, you know, sort of at that moment I thought, well, actually, you know, I probably ought to look after me now, and you know, this is a good business, and I, you know, should listen to everybody else and do, you know, make something of it and grow it, and I actually did go on some learning courses, better late than never. You know, and learned a great deal about scaling up from some incredibly talented and knowledgeable people. You know, but so unlike the earlier years, I actually had the know-how. But what I didn't really have is the heart. You know, it's so easy to do it for something external, to do it for yourself. You know, it didn't do it for me.
Yeah. No, that's very honest, Jan, and I think a lot of people can learn from that, definitely. So can we just talk about that venture of yours coming to an end, Jan?
And how that
actually came to an end then for you?
Well, I spent, it was a very long end, is the answer to that, because I guess, you know, I spent probably about 8 or 9 years, maybe, so it's certainly 6 or 7, you know, where I'd have meetings with people, sort of various VCs and things that were talking about buying it out, and, you know, I started getting increasingly unhealthy. And health problems and
right.
hospital and operations and all sorts, and tremendous stress. Can't even talk about it. But well, it was a very stressful period. You know, and I kept on thinking, right, it's got to go. I'm going to sign a deal tomorrow. And then I'd look at the deal and think, that's going to come back and bite me. Because unfortunately, a lot of, when you're desperate to sell a business, there are some very sharky VCs around. I'm not saying all VCs are unpleasant and bad or anything else, because otherwise I might get a lot of people not being very fond of me. But at the bottom end, when, as you know, it gets out there on the grapevine that somebody's desperate and not well, then the sharks do gather. And I was stupid. I passed up one good deal. And then others that came along, you know, I kept on seeing that actually right at the last minute that, you know, there was one, for example, to give you a typical one, that yes, okay, they took the business and everything looked fine. But actually in that small print, if anything went wrong with the business, the debts would have stayed with me, whether I still owned it or not.
Wow.
And wow. Yeah, exactly. I mean,
that
really,
stuff actually,
you know,
goes
really
on.
Nasty things.
Yeah.
Sorry?
That stuff actually goes on then. That's,
it actually goes on. Wow. Yes. I mean, you know, and so it, you know, I was getting increasingly desperate. The business was going increasingly downhill, and a competitor approached me and said, you know, how are you finding things? And I said, oddly enough, I did think of getting in touch with you, because I've just had enough. And he said, well, I wouldn't want to take business over because I'm in London and, you know, you're in East Anglia. But I would be interested in some of your staff. And the thing that I'd made the biggest success of the part of business was the brand name, and because of the sales background, of course. Yeah. And oddly enough, the designs. And I think the only reason for that was because I'm not a designer, never was a designer, but I was very motivated by what sold. So, I just went about designing and coming up with furniture ideas based on what people wanted, which, of course, is in many ways much better than other companies who have some designer who thinks they're frightfully clever and doesn't necessarily listen to the clients. Yeah. So the designs were strong, the brand name was very strong, and that was what he was after. And he was also desperately short of good staff, because that was another thing in the furniture industry. There were very few people working in it by that time.
Right.
You know, and it meant busting the furniture manufacturing side, you know, but letting, you know, striking a deal for the brand and getting out sort of virtually overnight. And I thought, I've just passed so many opportunities. You know, it could even get worse, and I don't care anymore. I have got to get out. And this means that the good stuff will have jobs, and, you know, I just can walk away and wash my hands of the whole thing, and that's what I did. Which was a sticky, grotty ending to a long time, but it was so much the right decision. And I think you asked me something about sort of regrets and failures.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people would say that that's the most obvious answer was what happened at the end. It wasn't really. I think my biggest regret is I didn't get out sooner, because I should have got out when I stopped being in love with the business and loving what I was doing. Yeah. I should never have gone on, and don't anybody who's listening do it. You know, go on, because you should do, you know, for 6 or 7 years, ruining your health and being in virtual tears every morning when you get up with misery.
Absolutely. I think there's that kind of message that people say, you know, don't quit. But quite clearly, when you get to the stage that you got to, Jan, where you were making yourself poorly and you'd lost the passion for it, then that's quite clearly the best decision to do is cut that out of your life.
It absolutely had to be, you know, and there just wasn't a shadow of my mind. And you know, and there was this enormous, because it was a very sudden decision, really. And, you know, there was this enormous question mark in my mind as to, you know, what on earth happens next. I mean, I thought I'd probably retire, and I wasn't, it wasn't necessarily going to leave me as well off as I might have expected once upon a time, but, you know, I just felt so burnt out. And so scared, and I just went home and drew all the curtains and got into bed, and you know all the things one does under those circumstances, you know. And even on the next day, you know, I woke up thinking, "Thank God for that." Does this really feel as good, you know, as it does? Mm. Because I mean, okay, there was a lot to tidy up still, but you know, it was actually all over. The decision was made, and that decision I'd been fighting for those years so hard. You know, so no, it was very much the right thing to do by that time.
Yeah, definitely. So the weight was off your shoulders then, and taking it up to current times then, John, and just so what we're doing now then, and
what are we doing now? Yeah, good question. Yeah. We are following our passion and doing something which we enjoy a lot more. Is the simple answer to that. Yeah. As I say, my intention had been to retire, and I certainly spent a few months in a heap, sort of very burnt out heap. You know, thinking, you know, sort of, this is absolutely it and I'll never do anything again. And then I thought, actually, you know, the one thing I've always wanted to do is write. And indeed, I'd started writing for a business publication by way of diversion in those last years of the business, and it had been the thing that made me happy. You know, I thought I'll give a book a crack, and nothing will ever come of it, you know, because I would have no idea how to self-publish, and, like, you know, nobody can get a publishing contract these days. But, you know, what the hell, I'll give it a go, you know. And then I thought, what do I write about? And, you know, whatever it is, 30 odd years plus of running businesses, various, because I had a few before I got married. You know, and you know, has got to be some experience. And as I say, I'd actually gone back and done some serious learning as well. You know, and in the scaling, I mean, you know, but I did, because by that time it was quite a size. You know, I'd also got very familiar with some of the things I did right, and a lot of the things I've done wrong as well. And, you know, I could see, if I'd wanted to go on, and had the drive to go on, what would have been the things that needed working on, and what pitfalls were, or a lot of them. And so I thought, well, you know, that's really my specialist subject, is you know, all the mistakes I made, and you know, the few things I do know, you know, about scaling a business. And maybe actually if I start writing about that, it might be of some use to people, because, you know, actually growing a business is tougher than starting one. 100%. particularly at that stage, it's the toughest stage of growth, and you know, so that's what I did, and to my amazement, I got offered a contract by Bloomsbury, which you know, in itself was just a dream come true.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, well done, John. And I'm really looking forward to reading the book once it's released as well. I'm a business owner myself, and I can say that it's not easy to start a business. It's easy to start a business, but it's the things that come after that, and that's the part that your book's going to help a lot of people do. So yeah, just taking it back, John. What actual size of the company did you get it to? How many?
At one stage there were about 40 employees, and we were sort of multi-million turnover. So a fair size.
Yeah, right. Brilliant. That's fantastic. So you've had quite a lot of obviously failure and mistakes throughout the career, just like everyone does, John. And just wanted to get your opinion on failure, and do you think it's a given that failure is going to happen?
Sorry. No, sorry, I interrupted you, Alice.
Yeah,
what were you going to say?
I was just going to kind of say, what advice would you give to people who go through failure, and what kind of mindset do you have to take on?
I think, it was funny when that I decided to shut up shop as such. The decision was all made and it was all organized sort of over November and December, but everybody was in agreement we wouldn't actually tell anybody who was still working for me till the first day back in January, so they could have A, Christmas without any worry, and B, Christmas pay, which is what we organized to do. But of course I knew. And so I gave it an awful lot of thought as to how I was going to handle mindset, because, you know, I could see it might be a huge challenge, you know, and I'm not possibly the person, somebody who puts themselves on a great pedestal anyway. I'm given to a lot of self-criticism. So, it could have really sent me reeling. And I watched, the falling forward speech, and I'm going to forget who it's by now. Have you ever come across it?
I've seen it.
That's
in
Washington.
That's the one. Yeah.
And I was just gobsmacked. It really hit me in the right place. I thought it was so brilliant, and I thought, yeah, that's what it's all about. You know, you learn from that. And failing is part of life, and you move forward, and it really gave me the strength to go on.
Absolutely, yeah. It brings me to my next point, that, John, quite nicely. So I've read recently a book from Jack Canfield. Are you familiar with Jack Canfield?
I know who Jack Canfield is. Yep.
Yeah. I think he wrote the Chicken Soup for the Soul book.
Indeed.
Yeah. And my mum actually used to read me those when I was a young child.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, that was much more useful than what I got read.
So I think that those early stories from them type of inspirational stories is probably what have helped me in my journey without knowing, really. But anyway, he's released a book called The Success Principles. And there was something in that book, and he talks about events and reactions. So there's always two things in life: events and reactions. And obviously we can't control the events, but one thing we can control is how we react to those events. And I think that ties in nicely with failure and, you know, stuff that you can't control. So can you just give us an example of an event that happened to you, Jan, and then your reaction?
I mean, I looked at this question because it was one of the ones you sent me through, and, you know, I thought, I kept on writing down things that had happened to me in my business career, ready to speak to you about it. And then I kept on thinking, I can't get rid of some responsibility in that. You know, it was my business. It was my choice to have a business. It was my choice to take a risk. It was my choice to take that person on. You know, I mean, it was quite challenging, especially in the early days. You know, there was a lot of violence on the shop floor. You know, for a sole woman to run a business like that in a manufacturing town, you know, I would have, you know, there were various occasions where I had furniture thrown at me and things, or equipment thrown at me, and, you know, all sorts of stuff. I mean, actually, that didn't faze me as much as other things that happened to me. But, you know, but that was just luck that it didn't faze me. But, you know, I still chose to do it. I can't, you know, yes, they chose to do it, and I probably didn't, you know, wouldn't have gone through it by absolute choice. But, you know, it still was, wouldn't have happened. It's sliding doors, isn't it? You set a chain of events, and you are part of those choices, I think.
Well, I think that comes to taking full ownership as well. I think that's what you're doing there. You're saying that was my decision, and, you know, so I'll take ownership for that. And I think there's a lot of peace to be found in taking responsibility for things as well, because you kind of take control of it then yourself.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Alex. I think actually, you know, you don't realise till you finally grow up enough to start doing it, and it did take me a long time. Mm. But, you know, actually it is the only thing that gives you some peace is, you know, you can say, you know, not all the stuff of it doesn't matter or it's not my fault, but actually, you know, I did have a plan of hand in that, you know, and that's okay. That's part of life, and some things I did right and some things I did wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot easier to live with.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. So obviously you were a leader of a big team at one point, Jan. So how would you define great leadership, and can you just give us an example of a great leader that you've come across in your own career and life, Jan?
I mean, I think I've met, you know, sort of particularly doing a book, because I got contrary, you know, I didn't want to solely rely on my knowledge and experience, goodness know. So, you know, I involved a lot of people who I either knew at the time or got to know, and I've met and talked to some amazing people through that. You know, and you just, you know, think, wow, you know, just incredible. You know, it's difficult to express how much in awe I am about some of the people I've got to speak to. You know, but I think gleaning from, you know, everything I've learned from them, I mean, I think you have to make you a good leader. You know, and I certainly didn't achieve this necessarily at all. But you have to have... be quite self-developed yourself and be prepared to work on yourself. But you also have to value yourself enough to look after yourself well enough, which is where I was particularly weak, you know, because it's a challenge and you need to do your best game all the time. And you can't do that when you're tired and exhausted and everything's going wrong. You know, there was one... guy I spoke to, and he used to work, very, 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 very successful guy. He used to work school term times. You know, I mean, nothing to do with kids, but, you know, at that stage, I'm not even sure he had kids at that stage, but, you know, he would actually sort of set himself that cycle so he could take time off and have, you know, proper recuperation. You know, and I actually get a sense about it. I don't know quite how he managed it. I think he had an astounding management team and they probably took it in turns. But, you know, then you can actually work at your peak. And I think it's really important that a leader invests in themselves. And we're not very good at doing that by our natures, because we think it's selfish and horrible and, you know, we oughtn't to do it and we're not good enough and we don't deserve it. But actually, to make you a good leader, you have to start there. And then in turn after that, sorry, I hope I'm not rambling on this one, I've learned so much from others on it, and you know, a lot of messages come through again and again, finally sunk into my brain. You know, and you know, I think you need the right team. But you also, once you have them, you need to find the right team who actually want to develop. And you need to concentrate on their development and encourage them to develop, and allow them the freedom to do their own thing and entrust them to do it. You know, but that means finding the right people, which is a skill in itself.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. I think it comes down to. When getting people on board, it's a common thing that I've seen, Jan. The people working around you need to be on the same vision, along with the same vision as you, and not just turning up to, you know, collect a wage. You've got to have them invested in your vision, and I think that is how you get the best out of people, and certainly how I've reacted best to working for people in the past.
I absolutely 100% agree. And of course, I mean, that was, you know, looking back, I didn't see it at the time, but that was one of the sort of faults of my business, because, you know, I'd got four people at the beginning who were very happy working in little farm buildings, and, you know, they didn't want to, you know, really nice people. But, yeah. You know, the last thing I wanted to do was be involved in a high-growth business and have to learn X, Y, and Z. It wasn't what they were after in life. But, of course, that was my skilled people and the people I felt ought to have responsibility in the company. So, you know, major, major fault line right from day one, you know.
So is that something you'd maybe go back and change if you could?
And Yeah, I mean, yes, I would, and I'd have changed it early on, not later on when it was too late in the day. I think, you know, you've got to, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I never sat down and thought, you know, at the beginning and thought I'm capable of building a business to, you know, that size. It wouldn't have occurred to me. So I didn't really have a plan as such to do that. And you know, it was just firefighting and going with the flow. And, okay, well, that's the next challenge. That could be fun. So I didn't put the structures into place that you need. You know, I tried with some of them. You know, sort of things like, you know, sort of sufficient job descriptions and job manuals and systemization. Yeah. But the actual structure of the team, I never got right to grow with. You know, so, and you can't do it without.
Well, that's it's just one of those. Jan, you've gone through all that and you know now and you're wiser from it and you can hopefully pass that on to other people through the forum.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, I could have had everything in place and I still wouldn't have had to drive really to do it because of kids not being around anymore. But I mean, I loved learning about it because, you know, I love entrepreneurship. I'm passionate about it being an enabler for people to take control of their lives, to have a chance when the economy is as dicey as it is at the moment, to you know, even if it's a side hustle or a business of their own, you know. And I did a lot of campaigning when I had the business for entrepreneurship schemes to try and help other people to, you know, get launched and work with schools and unis and business groups and things. Mm. And it's something I feel really, really strongly about, you know, to give people that chance. Yeah. So, you know, I did get a lot of knowledge, you know, and hopefully I can pass that on.
Yeah, now we're here today and you're ready to do that and you sound like you've got the passion back for it, Jan, which I'm very happy to see.
I'm so happy in comparison these days. It's, you know, I'm a different person, you know. It's lovely.
It's all part of the journey and
absolutely.
Do you have any regrets at all?
I mean, I could go down that route when I'm tired and miserable, I mean, there are things that I could, you know, I'd rather didn't happen or I didn't do or, you know, I could change, but, you know, it's a pointless expedition. I try not to do it.
Yeah, and that comes again down to, you know, we can't change it. It's happened.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't be where you are today without these things happening. So let's not focus on that.
I wouldn't. And, you know, it was what I wanted to do when I was a child. And, you know, whatever happens with the book, and obviously, you know, you do anything, you hope it's successful. But to get a contract with Bloomsbury as a book addict, you know, that in itself is just, wow, I did that. Wow, I can't believe that. Real bucket list stuff. I'm just so thrilled and excited and honoured.
Yeah, and that'll hopefully, you know, give you confidence as well, Jan, because
absolutely.
Not many people can say they've signed a contract with, you know, Bloomfield. So, brilliant.
No.
So let's talk about your book then, Jan. Your book. So what's the book? What's it about? What's your aim? And when can we get a copy?
Right. Well, it is called Scale for Success. Just spelling it right, aren't there? Scale for Success.
Yeah.
So, and it's coming out. It's available for pre-order now, but it's actually officially out on the 4th of February. in the UK and on Kindle everywhere, obviously. And it'll be published hard copy in Australia and America and various other places, I think. You know, a couple of months later, once the shipping gets going, which obviously is a bit slower at the moment with pandemics and things. But Force of Feb is the actual official UK publishing launch.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. It seems to be suddenly sort of virtually here. And it takes the reader on a sort of bit of a journey through all the aspects of business, looking at you know, vision, as you say, so rightly say, and values, and all the financial side of things, and people and leadership, and sort of elementary mergers and acquisitions, and without getting too above myself, and you know, as just supply chains, and you know, sort of a bit of everything is covered in there, with, as I say, the help of some super amazing people. And their input as well from all over the globe. I mean, you know, mostly from Britain, but not exclusively. I've got people from Australia and people from the States as well.
Right. Excellent.
So you know, you've got a sort of Stanford lecturer teach you something in the book, which is, I find, pretty exciting.
Brilliant. Yeah. So obviously I'll attach a link and pre-order link in the comments and for people to get a hold of that. Will it be coming out on Audible?
Oddly enough, I asked my editor the other day, I never got an answer. And you're quite right; I need to chase it up. I mean, I would hope so, but I don't think, you know, like everybody. Oddly enough, the publishing date came right forward unexpectedly. I think, you know, sort of again, probably with various things going on in the pandemic, but and we were ready and it was all set to go, so you know, which is great. But I think one or two things like Audible might be in a bit of a scurry, but I hope so, because a lot of people do prefer to listen to it like that.
Yeah, well, that's my personal preference, really, Jan, because that's, I can listen to audiobooks while I'm working through the day, and that's how I take it in.
I will continue to try and ask them.
I'm sure you will.
Meanwhile, you might have to lift a book again.
Yeah, that shouldn't be a problem. Right, Jan, we're coming towards the end now, Jan, and I think it's been a great chat. And again, I'm very grateful for you joining us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so just a couple of last questions, Jan. Give me a fact about you that most people will not know.
Now, I'd struggle with this, because I thought, you know, I'm a fairly open book and most people know most things, but I have got three kidneys. How about that one?
Three kidneys?
I have. You're not going to get many people tell you that.
Right, yeah, that's very interesting, yeah. Brilliant. How come? How did that come about?
You're just digesting that one, aren't you?
Right.
Just so happens, apparently, it's slightly more common than you might imagine. But if you don't have your kidneys, you know, x-rayed for any reason, you know, lots of people don't find out about it. I mean, it's not dead common, but you know, people do occasionally have three. One's a sort of twin.
Right, okay.
it's still cool to having three kidneys.
Yeah. Yeah, it's learn something new every day, don't you? last one then, Jan. So if you had the power to invite anyone in the world, and that's past or present, into this interview with us right now, who would you choose and why? Get you thinking.
Yeah. Um, Oh, it's so sickly, but I'd have to say my son because I miss him so much.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's ever in Oz.
Yeah.
Any possible advantage to try and get him into anything and chat to him is always my priority. But I know that's not really what you're looking for.
Yeah. No, no, that's completely your choice. And then, and I can understand why you would. So that's fine, John. Yeah. So where can people connect with you? And if you just want to let people
know. Sure, they can go to my website, which is Jan Cavell, and I spell it JanCavelle, and I'm .co.uk.
Okay.
And I'm on all the social medias. I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. Jan Cavell Writer on Facebook is my actual sort of writing page. Mm-hmm. And you'll find me because Cavell, Jan Cavell is not that easy, ordinary a name. You'll find me very easily on all of them because I am just under Jan Cavell.
Right. Unique. Yeah. Right. Okay, Jan. Yeah. That's excellent. So thank you very much for chatting with us and sharing your story, Jan. It's been a very, very interesting chat. And hopefully the listeners can take some knowledge and put it into their own lives, Jan. Yeah, thank you very much. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, I hope you wish you all the best in
thank
the future.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Jan. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. You take care.
Bye now.
Thanks for listening to another inspiring self-made story, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We would be very grateful if you could kindly leave us a review, as it will help us impact a wider audience. You can do this on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. If you want to reach out on the socials, find us across all platforms using at the Self-Made Minds Podcast. See you next time, and happy success making.